Welcome to Unfrozen. I am Dan Safarik, and back from the dead
is Greg Lindsay. Our guest this week is me. I'm the guest because I missed the last few guests because, yes, Dan, that's how things are going here in the world of Omicron, particularly for those of us who are parents. I say I had to drop off of our, two episodes ago I had to drop off because I was homeschooling my child from the wilds of Massachusetts because of virtual school. And last time around, unfortunately, I had to miss it because I was sick with the Rona. But I'm back, as you said, resurrected Lazarus style here to discuss the latest and greatest trends in architecture. Number one of which I want to bring up is the Winter Olympics. They're underway as we tape this. The opening ceremonies are happening now in China. I would say we were just riffing before this. To me, the most amazing thing I thought about with the Winter Olympics is, unlike 2008, there is no iconic images here. I couldn't tell you who the architects are. I could tell you about Herzog and Demeron, and I could tell you about the bird's nest and all of that. But this time, the architecture has taken a decided backseat, partly because of COVID and partly just because of the whole bizarreness of it. And yeah, I mean, as someone who spent several years in China, I'm curious your thoughts now on like on how these Beijing Games are being perceived. I'm reading more about the Western media, making sure to bring up just to like poke them every now and then their human rights abuses. The discourse has very much changed in the last 14 years. It's very fascinating.
Oh yes, it's no longer the open arms that we saw in 2008. That was like in the sense that, the ping pong diplomacy then led to, Nixon's opening of China and the gradual Deng Xiaoping era kind of culminated really in the 2008 Olympics. It was China's arrival on the world stage is certainly in terms of attracting architecture from around the world. A lot of those venues are being repurposed this year. I've seen some discussion on several levels. I think they're projecting, they're trying to split the difference very carefully here, right? Because, there's obviously the geopolitical concerns are very high right now with not only COVID transmission, but also China's human rights record, which is under extreme scrutiny from the international community, which has more or less decided to boycott the Olympics, at least not sending any officials. Not that they really could have achieved that anyway with all the COVID restrictions.
But I was to say there the list of foreign dignitaries who are attending the opening ceremonies is just hilarious because it's basically like it's Prince Rainier of Monaco and other handful of like tiny principalities, and then basically like the most debtor nations to China, the president of Argentina is there because they're looking for bailouts. Vladimir Putin. I say one thing that hasn't changed obviously is that again the Russians are invading their neighbors. In 2008 it was Georgia, and here of course on the border. Ukraine. So some things never change.
But yeah, of course.
But it is interesting when you put it that way. You mentioning obviously the Beijing Games 2008. Obviously one of the most epochal events of the 21st century so far. If we look back, I think in the very long run, 9/11, of course, I mean, it triggered many, many horrible things and mass death in various nations. But arguably more important in the long run is going to be the admission of China to the WTO in 2001. And what that did to sort of the final blow to sort of globalization and inequality in so many nations. And of course, the Beijing Games 7 years later is the architectural and event manifestation of that. And I don't know. It's very interesting to think through. I'm sure we could graph out basically ascendancy of empires and of course their magnificent architecture to accompany it. I mean, the Beijing Games of 2008 is probably their equivalent of Crystal Palace in 1851 in London, of course. And the American version of that is probably the Columbian Exposition or maybe the 3940 World's Fair of New York. Arguably, would be that. With of course the 64-65 is the sort of sad decline of modernism and echo of that. It's just sort of interesting. We could sort of trace that through. And yeah, I mean, it is interesting to watch us all clutch pearls rightfully so. I mean, what you know, China is doing genocide in Xinjiang. I mean, you know, from a destruction of culture standpoint, it is certainly a form of ethnic cleansing. But yeah, like, you know, the British Empire, the United States had the Columbian Exposition 5 years before it began, you know, its own reign of empire, the Spanish-American War and brutal counterinsurgency in the Philippines. It's sort of interesting, you know, the role of architects as handmaidens to the ascendancy of these empires and their role in that, which I guess is what makes the Winter Games so interesting. You know, Beijing coming back around 14 years later and due partly to their own zero COVID policy, you know, like it's sort of like, I don't know, it sort of vanished. It'll be interesting. I'm going to watch the games tonight here on the time delay with my family. So it'll be curious to see how that spectacle manifests, you know, particularly after the very more modest Tokyo games, reusing venues, et cetera. And I don't know, one point here is like, you know, from a spectacle standpoint, I just picture IOC and FIFA like just like white knuckling their way through 2022, be like, if we can just hold on this year through the odiousness of Beijing, and then later at the end of the year of the Qatar, you know, a World Cup, you know, after that you get into much more respectable nations. In 2024, you get Paris for the Summer Games. In 2026, you get, you know, Lake Como for the Winter Games, and I think that's the US Canada one for the Cup. And then in 2028, you get Los Angeles. Like, it's all smooth sailing once you get through the year of the dictators. So.
Yeah, I mean, well, then you have Paris in 2024.
Yeah, exactly. Then you get like perfectly respectable Western nations after that. So,
yeah. Well, we'll see. I'm sure they'll screw it up somehow, but the prospects are a lot better. Yeah. No. I mean, what's interesting is that the few new projects. There's only one project by a Western architecture firm that's happening in the Beijing Olympics, which is the speed skating oval by Populous, formerly of HOK. And then everything else is being done by local architects, or it's a renovation of an existing, an existing project. So that's telling. One of the firms that has done the ski jump, I guess they're calling it a Big Air, Shouguang Big Air, is actually derived from one of the architectural design institutes. Which are the organizations that are sort of, they're kind of like the local architect of record in China, but they're also quasi state owned. You more or less have to work with them, even if you are a prestigious international architect. So if you're designing something there, you're going to be working with one of these so-called LDIs, local design institutes. So this, the one that designed the ski jump is called Studio Minus.
Uh-huh.
Which is kind of funny. And that's an outgrowth of the Tsinghua Design Institute, which is affiliated with the university there. I don't really know too much about them, except that these LDIs are in every big city in China, and they end up doing a lot of the construction documents and the real work.
That's interesting. That raises a couple of interesting questions. One, has Populous made any statements about their participation in this? You know, I mean, I remember... God, what was it? It was the infamous Kuhlhaas Manifesto, I think, that was in the book Content 2004, where, you know, they claimed that they'd walked away from the World Trade Center reconstruction competition in a huff because they were setting their sights eastward. And then, of course, you know, built CCTV, you know, so REM participating in that, I thought was interesting. I haven't seen any, I'd be curious to know if Populous has said anything at all. I mean, being a sort of fairly corporate firm with no frontman, whether they've had to. And second, the sort of interesting about like, I mean, curious, like this hasn't been more of a moment then for sort of Chinese architecture, you know, or there's no, the fact that it's sort of, you know, more buttoned up, it sounds like. I'm curious what that means for the evolution of their ongoing architectural labor. Again, Kuhlhaas, I think it was in Great Leap Forward, famously calculated the total investment of Ivy League architecture salaries that were at the time, you know, pumping out office buildings across the Pearl River Delta. So I wonder what the equivalent is today from the finest institutes of China.
You know, I don't know. I mean, I honestly, things have kind of slowed down altogether. I think, you know, there's a couple of major pronouncements that have come out within the last year, you know, where things are becoming increasingly conservative for a variety of reasons. I mean, I think the real reason is that you know, the debt spending has gotten out of control, and Xi Jinping and his administration want to rein that in.
Well, yeah, no, I mean, Evergrande and the shadow that hangs over that. I don't know if you've been reading some of the press reports of that, not to interrupt, but I've been seeing some there's some crackdowns from the central government on some of the municipalities that are instituting all sorts of petty fines and things on local businesses to try to secretly make up for the shortfall in land sales that is now basically causing the whole financial model to invert. And the central party was being like, knock that shit off, because you will invalidate our rule if you start like basically nickel and diming the populace. So I thought it was really interesting to see some local leaders get disciplined for that. So yeah, the cracks are starting to show finally.
Oh yeah. Yeah. So I think, you know, this is sort of like the economy Olympics. I mean, they've obviously made, you know, huge investments in their existing infrastructure to get people out to the games. I mean, there's a new high-speed railway that opened up to get people out to the remote ski jump and the real you know, the remote sites that are built into hillsides and what have you. But you know, that was an investment made years and years ago, and I still think they're pretty big believers in infrastructure investment, but not so much the signature architecture. No more weird buildings, of course, we've been hearing that for several years. And certainly, you know, lots of caution with, you know, foreign architecture and foreign influences. They definitely want things to have more and more Chinese characteristics, even if it means, you know, inviting in fewer and fewer international experts, as we are sometimes called. You know, the truth is they don't really need the expertise. I mean, they do have, for years and years of building, they have built up their own domestic industry. And this goes across all types of industry, but architecture production is not an exception to that. I was surprised not to see anything by MAD, Ma Yansong's firm.
Yeah, that's kind surprising of
the
too.
International architects who are actually, you know, based in China.
Exactly.
Yeah, I mean, when they were doing the Lucas Museum, I paid it was the Chicago, the erstwhile Chicago Lucas Museum.
I say so many failed Lucas museums, you have to delineate there, yeah.
Yeah, I actually was in their Beijing office, and they had a substantial orange cat walking around that they had nicknamed George.
Very nice. That's a very good pun. I'm glad to see they still have that going for them. But
yeah,
well, that was it. It's like Larry the Cat at number 10 Downing Street. I was watching, of course, the various resignations by various Boris advisors. So we got that whole backdrop there, and you know, Larry will be the last one standing, because Larry is, as some of you may know, is not, in fact, the Prime Minister's cat. Larry is an employee of 10 Downing Street. I was very privileged to meet him a few years ago when I got to visit 10 Downing. Yeah.
Well, that is just wonderful. You know, I think cats are going to come out on top, you know, no matter what happens. You know, they haven't caught COVID. They haven't, you know, had to deal with inflation or unemployment. They're pretty much just still doing their thing. They're owning the internet.
There you go. Well, it'll be interesting in the Olympics. So if this is the COVID austerity games, like London 48, then it will be interesting to see like what the spatial manifestations of like the next, you know, Olympic games will be, or these events. Couldn't tell you anything about what FIFA is doing in Qatar. I don't know what the stadiums look like. Obviously, you know, what's happening with Expo is happening right now in Dubai, and, you know, beautiful pavilions. Carlo Ratti did the Italian pavilion. There's some interesting architecture happening there. Unfortunately, I guess it looks like I won't be able to make it there before it ends. But it is interesting. So, I mean, Paris, I know, for example, is going to be the venue where urban air mobility is supposed to finally make the, you know, the prime time, so to speak. You know, there's multiple corridors being designated for where there will be the equivalent of air taxis, you know, human-sized drones, which is interesting. You know, the Tokyo Games was supposed to be Japan's coming out party for autonomous vehicles and sort of displaying their technology there, but that obviously fizzled with the pandemic. And then after Paris, you know, I know when I was in LA this past fall for Commotion, you know, Stephanie Wiggins, who's the CEO of Metro now, you know, laying out this grand vision of you know, trying to create like the walkable games, you know, a metro, you know, an urban scale here, but trying to do everything as sustainable as possible. And so it's interesting to sort of see like the reflections of, you know, political economies and spatial goals in cities, you know, is reflected through these mega events, which of course, like the one upside of doing a mega event is that it allows that brief moment, right, of political consensus and infrastructure spending. Like, I'm fairly convinced that's what the only reason cities bid to host these games is because it allows you to actually herd the cats for a brief window of time.
It really is like a coalition of the willing, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, all these organizations that are always at each other's throats, you know, come together. I mean, even the, you know, the 84 Olympics in LA, some unthinkable things happened. You know, they changed the traffic flow on Olympic and Pico boulevards. They, you know, came up with a unified graphical system. I think that was the Deborah Sussman's firm. You know, not much in the way of public transportation, but definitely they reconfigured some very hardwired, you know, driving habits of Angelenos in favor of, you know, creating a copacetic event. And it was largely regarded as a success. There weren't too many architectural venues that lasted from that. I think they predominantly reused the 1932 Coliseum. But yeah, this time around, 28 LA, I'm cautiously optimistic. They've made a huge investment in trying to build out the metro system, which has been steadily supported by bond issues. I mean, obviously it hasn't been a perfect execution, but you know.
Yeah. Well, Measure M is fascinating. I'm going to come back to the larger Olympic sweep there in a second, but Measure M is fascinating in LA because there's an actual Onion headline, which is like, you know, 99% of Angelenos support public transit so that they can drive while you take the train. And Measure M, actually, that is actually true. The surveys show that Angelenos voted to tax themselves to spend $100 billion on transit so that you would take the train so they can drive in peace. So, you know, so it's interesting, interesting thing there. But yeah, it is, I mean, the games, so two things in the games. I recently learned that the failure of the Montreal Games in 76, which bankrupted the city and led to, in many ways, like secessionist movements, the whole, I mean, repercussions for 40 years. The failure of the Montreal Games in 76 led directly to the success of the 84 Los Angeles Games in terms of its privatization. So also we can sort of see here, like, the failure of modernism. I would argue that like the day modernism failed was not when they demolished Pruitt-Igoe. It was like when the Buckminster Fuller Dome burned in Montreal after Expo 67 and amidst like the mounting failures and cost overruns of the Olympic Games, that led directly to like the neoliberalized 84 Los Angeles Olympics, where they made a ton of money off television revenue. So, you know, there you go, the Reagan Games. But then, you know, then obviously Barcelona 92 being the other famous successful summer games, which was sort of the capstone on their urban revitalization project, you know, the sort of post-industrial revitalization of their waterfront. And then, yeah, then like those two games were used to justify a lot of bad investments. I mean, Sydney sort of escaped unscathed in 2000, Athens 2004, like obviously the preview of the financial crisis in the Eurozone there. And then we've discussed Beijing, London 2012, the revitalization of the East has not, you know, Stratford did not as happen as much as they hoped it would. 2016 yeah. Rio, another epic sort of disaster there, which triggering our whole rethink of the model. So I don't know. It will be interesting. I'm a fan of the whole provision that like Los Angeles should just host the games forever. You know, pick a permanent site and probably make it LA.
I'm sure there's plenty of politicos in LA who would support you on that.
I'm sure there are. You know, it'd be interesting to sort of make it a permanent World's Fair kind of venue there. Well, in any case, well, moving on. So, you know, in addition to, you know, the Winter Olympics, the other thing on my calendar, Dan, is I am, now that I'm recovered and pumped full of antibodies, the old fashioned natural way, I'm going back on the road. I am in Orlando next week for the International Builders Show. NAHB is moving ahead with its flagship event. I mean, you know, Orlando Convention Center. I won't say anything about my hosts, but all of you think about what that's going to be like. From a potential infection standpoint, we're all going to be vaccinated and masked and as safe as we can be. But there you are. But I'm very interested in attending because, you know, obviously, like, you know, the housing bubbles continue to run uninflated in both the United States and Canada. And also, I'm very curious. The thing I'm most curious to see on the exhibit floor and popping into sessions is learning more about the rise of single family rentals. I mean, you know, obviously, like inflation ran at 7% in December. Like, you know, the Fed is a massive inflation hawk. The markets are tanking because they're all scared that money's going to get expensive. Also, you know, Meta is shrinking there in the backdrop. But yeah, you know, a big chunk of that inflation rise was rent, right? Rents, you know, up, you know, I forget exactly. It depends on which measure you're using, but like, you know, running above core inflation. I've seen rent growth as high as 18% in 2021. And, you know, and this has, you know, big investors like our friends at like, you know, the Black Rocks, the Black Stones, and other, you know, names combined like that are you know, investing heavily back into, forms of rental housing. You know, CBRE estimated, you know, in one of their reports recently, I think it was their 2020 trends report, that like, you know, that their wild card scenario for multifamily housing could go from $7 trillion as a worldwide asset class to like $37 trillion. based on potential overseas growth if it grows into an asset class. So that happening globally, and then also the rise of single family rental happening stateside, which alarms me, Dan, because it's a couple of things. One is, you know, the fact that, you know, the United States, of course, prizes homeownership as its route to building wealth. I think we could all question that model. But rather than pursuing that in a sort of like German context where there's like seven big, you know, landlords and it's all a very regulated system, we're pursuing it in the sense of like, you know, rent to own, like Blackstone's newest company, or renting forever. The rise of, you know, for example, of six-figure earning households that do not own homes that are now just basically, you know, they're targeting these sort of rental homes. And of course, you know, the rise of, you know, of people migrating out of, you know, coastal urban metros into some of these other areas like Nashville and others are also fueling this trend because those housing markets got so hot so fast that people couldn't buy and now they're renting there as well. So I'm curious where this goes because, you know, from an architectural standpoint, this harkens back to our interview with Kate, you know, her talking about, you know, the fact that like, you know, yeah, housing construction in America is, you know, individual builders for individual preferences. And, you know, there's, of course, various models from Toll Brothers and Lennar and others. But, you know, we're on the cusp of like this whole new model of like mass producing entire neighborhoods, maybe not with mass production techniques, but like, you know, fleet level management of housing, you know, using new technology, using potentially, you know, interiors that were designed for more industrial fittings, you know, because you want the ROI on that rental property to last longer. You know, I've had these kinds of conversations, you know, with these kinds of firms that are like, no, like, you know, housing is becoming a commercial asset class. Like that's one of my riffs, right? Like during the pandemic, housing became commercial real estate because it had to absorb working from home and logistics and everything else into it. But now you're seeing investors are actually thinking about it as this sort of financialized asset class that functions more like CRE. So I don't know. That's something that sits at the top of my mind here about like what's the post-pandemic future of housing in the States look like?
I'm sort of wondering too, you know, if this is something that's going to be, you know, balled together into a large asset class and productized. Is this the point where we start to see things like 3D printing really take off, especially considering what's happening with the continued disruptions in the, the lumber market, the traditional approach to building homes has
wood
been,
framing, as we saw in Venice. Yes, American framing right there, right? The wood framed house. Yeah.
I mean, there's firms like Icon in Austin that are doing this.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you say this literally. I didn't plan on this, but I got a press release this morning here in my inbox from Cobod 3D live at World of Concrete, which was in Vegas 2 weeks ago. You're absolutely right. I had not put that together in my head there about the labor shortage because labor prices are back up to where they were in their last spike. But it will be interesting to see if like that helps make the economics work, you know, in terms of 3D printed concrete, which so far seems more like a gimmick or a novelty, you know, than a really applicable technique, but potentially, yeah. But that's part of it. Just like cracking those housing construction costs, and maybe it makes more sense. You know, if you're gonna try to build 7,500 homes at once in a, you know, turnkey contract, like some of these builders are being offered. I think it's Puelta Homes is, you know, got a contract to build that level of housing development. Like, yeah, at that point, perhaps some of these mass deployment technologies start to make sense because you're not just doing a single job site. You can bring in an entire fleet of printers and start churning them out.
Yeah, bring in the robots. You know, it's the revolution is here.
No, absolutely. I mean, I covered that too. I've been following that for a while. There's all sorts of really interesting stuff there in housing construction tech. You know, either robots assembling bricks or you know, basically spraying concrete. I forget the name of the lab off the top of my head, but ETH Zurich actually is sort of like one of the leading centers or was as of a couple of years ago in this in terms of, yeah, I mean, they've done some great stuff and that really points to the possibilities there of like, you know, fractal, you know, what you could do is sort of like, you know, parametric design in terms of like beautiful, like Rococo, alien Rococo is how I think of it in terms of some of the beautiful printing you can do with concrete to produce complexity that no human artisan can actually be paid to do anymore. And also some of the really interesting sort of structural shapes you can do, even with just rebar, you can get some really interesting concrete forms of printing. So I don't know, there could be a real golden age for that. And you know, but even then it takes a while. I mean, we saw in Venice the bridge that Zaha Hadid designed that they 3D printed. I mean, apparently that took several years to actually make. So
I don't know that this hasn't actually turned into a well-oiled machine just yet, but the machines are definitely on their way. And I do think that the labor crunch is going to push things up farther, faster.
No, absolutely. I mean, automation being driven and everything there. So we'll see how that pushes. But the larger thing there too is also just like, you know, it'll be interesting to see, like, you know, with single family rental and the rise of this too. I don't know. I'd be curious about, you know, what, you know, do we still have starter homes? Like, what is the future of the starter home? Like, you know, does that even exist? Or is that now become a category that gets captured by some of these rentals? And, you know, like, or should we be thinking about what that means for American household wealth is something that I keep thinking a lot about. Again, I'm not totally a fan of the notion that speculating in housing should be an American rite of passage for those who can afford it. But it was the policy. What happens when that policy changes? And yeah, like the notion of it, you know, to me, the larger problem of, like, you know, you don't actually solve the homeownership problem by single family rentals. You're just basically meaning that the housing equity gains gets captured by Steve Schwartzman. Not sure that's a great policy outcome either for the United States, but
there right. I mean, there has to be some other way. There has to be some other way for people to build wealth if they're not going to be able to do that. I mean, I'm perfectly content to rent to infinity because, you know, I'll never get the capital together probably to buy something. But, you know, most people probably aren't, and it probably is part of their life plan to sort of build that up, particularly if they're going to have a family and, you know, someone to pass it down to. So either we need to figure out, you know, some kind of triangulation between, I don't know, universal basic income and government assistance with building up the equivalent of a pension, a 401k, something like that, somewhere in between, if we're not going to channel wealth into our own personal properties.
Well, it'll be interesting. There's that. And I mean, the countervailing trend too is, of course, the growing number of cities and even nations that are looking into rent control. I believe, if I recall correctly, I believe Spain just passed far-reaching rent control, which, you know, economists were duly quoted as saying that's a terrible idea. It will be interesting to see how they implement that at scale. But then in the States, I mean, St. Paul and Minneapolis instituting various rent control provisions, which of course then caused housing to basically stop in the city, which is another interesting political dilemma, because, you know, those on the left are basically perhaps correctly describing this as a capital strike. Like, you know, oh, we can't have the levels of profitability we want, so therefore we're not going to build. But it is certainly a perverse outcome of that. And it will be very interesting to see. That's something we're going to discuss with Kate. I always liked her formulation that, you know, that when it comes to like the yimby nimby divide, that like you need to build and you need protections, but the order matters in which you do those things. Otherwise you risk displacement. But that's like, you know, a massage of policy tools that no one's really yet perfected in terms of like, how do you do those increments? It's finely enough that you don't mess up the entire system. But it is interesting to watch cities are now turning back to rent control of this because they simply have no other idea how to make this work. So, you know, blunt force instruments are being employed again.
Yeah, I don't have a terribly strong opinion on rent control. I generally think that, you know, I guess I'm enough of a capitalist to think that the market can sort out some of these issues without having that imposed, or I should say without creating a market distortion, you know, but on the other hand, that doesn't mean that we should have unregulated capital doing whatever it wants. I mean, that's a very general statement, but when it comes down to these specific policy applications, I think it's really, really localized. It might even have to be localized at the level of neighborhoods or, dare I say, blocks, you know, because the demographics and the economic forces that are acting on very small parcels of cities are, you know, not necessarily attunable to a large scale policy.
No, absolutely. Yeah, well, it'll be interesting to see how it plays out. So yeah, speaking of unregulated capital, I'm a couple of weeks, I'll be in Phoenix speaking to Tiger 21, which is the largest membership organization for people who built businesses, cashed out, and are now planning what to do with their wealth. And so I'm going to be appearing on a real estate session with my friend Mary Ludgen from Heitman. So she's the chief head of research there. Mary's very big into discussing climate, and this is something that we've discussed in terms of climate migration. So that'll come up. And then, but yes, there'll also be a representative from Blackstone there. It'll be very interesting to see how this conversation goes. Of them discussing where they will literally place their bets, those who are in a privileged enough position to play roulette with the housing market. So I'll let you know how that goes, depending on what level of NDA they make me sign. So there's that. Other than that, yeah, that's basically, yeah, I've got a full, you know, full schedule of travel to sort of trace these out. So, you know, I've got talks to real estate groups and some others this spring. It'll be really interesting to sort of see how the tenor of this conversation goes with everyone talking about interest rates and inflation. And we know, you know, obviously housing traditionally seen as a hedge against inflation, something that goes back decades. The one thing I want to toss out here, and we should probably wrap this up soon, but the most remarkable book that I have read in the last few years in terms of like how America got to where it is today is, I don't know if you're familiar with Adam Smith, not the original economist, but the nom de guerre of Peter Goodman.
Yes, there you go.
So for listeners, Adam Smith was the Michael Lewis of his day. Like Peter Goodman was a financial journalist. He wrote for New York Magazine, and he adopted the Adam Smith moniker, I think, because he had a column in New York Mag. But I've read his books, and they are like the holy trinity of like describing like the American economy in the 60s, 70s, and early 80s. It was the money game, super money, and paper money. And they're really remarkable to read because reading what was then contemporary events as history today, you really start to see the pathways. I will say in his second book, he describes how basically the collapse of the New York Penn Railroad was nearly the Lehman Brothers of its moment. Imagine if they averted Lehman Brothers, truly. That's what they did in the 70s. And he writes about it. We're like, you know, New York Fed governors sitting at card tables in their garages all weekend because they can't get away from the phone because they're too terrified to leave. No cell phones. But
You mean the Penn Central.
The Penn Central Railroad. Yeah, which of course, you know, did collapse and led to Amtrak. But the collapse of the Penn Central like nearly, you know, wrecked the American economy. But he describes in his final book there, really made it underscored for me about how OPEC is like, I mean, we were listening earlier about China, the WTO, but OPEC and 73, the creation of OPEC and the 73 oil crisis, just how it changed everything, truly everything. I never understood the scope of like how like oil literally went up the price like by 10 times and like post-war industrial American prosperity simply became non-viable at that level in any way. And of course that led to, you know, end of the gold standard and neoliberalism and all this sort of stuff. But he got into there and like describing in early 80s California there about how people saw housing even then, the beginnings of like Prop 13, and seeing it as a hedge against the inflation that was starting to, that was running out of control in sort of the Paul Volcker era. Just really fascinating to see like the entire origins of that and how it's described. And just, it really underscored for me about like the origins of like this entire financial spatial regime that we now live in, that we just think of as a matter of course. Like it was sort of a policy choice, but then also it was sort of forced, their hands were forced by the fact that like suddenly, you know, oil wasn't $1 a barrel, it was $10 a barrel under OPEC, and the entire system kind of collapsed. All the petrodollars flying out the door and like suddenly, you know, massive foreign currency imbalances. I don't know, just really fascinating. And something I should note, you know, for any architects listening, it's like these are the kinds of things that like I think we all need to do a better job of understanding, because it's like the entire financial historical underpinnings of like everything that we're operating in today. So.
Yeah, financialization is really the game here. Some good books have come out on that fairly recently too. And I, by the way, I take any book recommendation from you very seriously. I am currently reading Anthony Townsend's Ghost Road.
Best book on autonomy written. I'd say Anthony's the only one who's grappled with like the larger spatial ramifications of a world of autonomy versus just like endlessly repeating claims about the tech itself there. So I can't wait to hear your review. Perhaps we could do a joint review at a few upcoming episode. I think that'd be great. It came out during the pandemic. The book was sadly underpublicized because it came out in 2020, but really remarkable stuff.
Yeah, no, definitely. So the one you just recommended was a 3-book series by Adam Smith called Super Money, Paper Money, and
The Money Game is the original one. So The Money Game is like the frothy 60s. Super Money is about, you know, the slowdown in the 70s. And then Paper Money is really about like, yeah, like sort of like the 80s anti-inflation hedges and sections on, you know, I mean, there's actually a moment where he actually prefigures the 2008 financial crisis, where just goes to show like the sort of zombie system we're in, where he, I mean, he basically said like at that point you'll have revolution if suddenly the spigots turned off and those gains are no longer assured. But somehow zombie capitalism staggered on, and to a point there, you know, the book I'm most looking forward to reading going forward is Yiannis Varoufakis, you know, the former Greek finance minister and economist, who has a great, you know, thesis coming out, and he's totally right, which is, you know, that we're living post-capitalism now. We're in some sort of techno-feudalism, because the two things that define capitalism, profits and markets, have stopped functioning. You know, markets have been internalized by the big tech platforms. And he pointed out that profits are no longer necessary because there's so much cheap money floating around that really it's just about access to borrowing and being propped up by the Fed and the Bank of England. And, you know, he has this great riff where he points out that, like, you know, when the Bank of England reported that the UK economy contracted by 20% during the pandemic, the markets went up because as he interprets it, that meant the cheap money will keep flowing. And now we're seeing the other side of it. The Fed having the temerity to raise rates is just causing the markets to absolutely freak out. So yeah, this kind of financialization, you know, that continues to drive it and the distortions are key to read.
So. Yeah, and I do think that rank and file architects and their architectural designer reports should be a little bit more attuned to this. I mean, I'm thinking back to my own clash with the 2008 rundown, which was, you know, there was a firm I was working for that was doing production housing in Arizona, and they would preemptively lay people off when there was a change in interest rates that would negatively affect their clients.
Wow.
Like, you know, Puente Homes and Lennar.
I mean, they shouldn't have done that, but I would say it's interesting to see like how those effects ripple through. You know, I won't name the company, but you know, I had a call during the pandemic with New Cities where I was, you know, trying to, you know, encourage them to fund a project I was trying to develop, and I literally pointed out to them, I'm like, hey, congratulations on your latest quarter and your profits in the billions. And as they pointed out to me, like, yeah, well, we just, you know, we laid off 20% of the firm to achieve those earnings for the street. Like, you know, like, and the same person explained to me that the repercussions of COVID as it ripples through tax bases and municipal budgets and what it means for public sector clients will take years to digest. You know, the person pointed out that, like, it wasn't in the case of financial crisis, it wasn't until 2011 that the full shockwave finally reached their level of projects. So it is interesting to, like, you know, for architects and contractors and others to you know, keep a finger on that pulse and understand where exactly those ripples are in the cycle.
Yeah, and I do hope, you know, referring, I guess, back to our original, you know, Olympics-centered discussion too, is that, you know, although it's very watered down, I do hope to see that some of this infrastructure investment that we've been talking about for years and years finally comes into play, and it couldn't come a moment too soon. We've got bridges collapsing everywhere, and, you know, that stimulus package needs to be a lot more effective than ARRA was.
It's finally infrastructure week. We'll see what kind of infrastructure we get. You know, I'm still very doubtful, about it. And I would say we could definitely, I know a few guests who can get in here and get into the weeds of the infrastructure bill and sort of what it means, you know, because yeah, we all agree that bridges need to be replacing. I love the whole American trope of like bridges. We got to build bridges, bridges to nowhere, bridges that collapse. The bridge is really like that iconographic infrastructure thing. I was just recently in Raleigh, North Carolina, speaking to the North Carolina Transportation Summit, you know, basically North Carolina DOT. And, you know, I forget who pointed it out on Twitter, but like, you know, state DOTs are like the chaotic evil of, you know, of American infrastructure investment. We're like, you know, the dead man's switch, you know, in terms of just expanding highways through communities of color, past any point we should be doing it. And they're still up to those tricks. So. Not what I recommended they do, but you know, we'll see. We'll see if they listen to me in North Carolina. Somehow I doubt it.
I'm still thrilled that all these organizations that, you know, on the face of them sound like patently evil, are, you know, listening to you. I mean, like, you're our last best hope, Greg.
Well, it was me and it was my friend Scott Shepard who was, you know, showing them all these great European planning models, and I just pictured so many people in the audience rolling their eyes at it, but. But yeah, I would say as a closing note, I ended my presentation at NCDOT with the metaverse. And I basically, you know, going back to our previous episode discussion of this, I warned them like, hey, tech companies are totally emboldened to just like totally drop entirely new regimes on top of what you're building. Like, have you thought about what's your plan for the metaverse? Unfortunately, it seems like, you know, Facebook just might collapse under its own weight. I mean, congratulations to Mark Zuckerberg on the largest single day destruction of wealth in the history of the planet. I mean, that really, really, really takes some doing there to obliterate $250 billion of market cap.
We're living in the Zuckerverse, man. You know, it's his Zuckerverse. We're just living in it.
Well, it's him. Apparently, like Amazon, I don't know, the markets are not looking so great, but if Amazon has a good day today, I mean, they'll gain $200 billion. It's actually Bezos world, or, you know, whatever his shares remain there. So,
you know, and just one last observation from a little news snippet that I caught. I think it was a Bloomberg story bringing us to the Bezos discussion. Apparently, they are going to be dismantling a railway lift bridge in Rotterdam because his super yacht won't fit under it.
Just to riff off somebody on Twitter, that is Lex Luthor shit right there. Like, you know,
totally.
next level. I mean, oh man. I mean, yeah. Do we need further clues at this point? Are people paying attention to like the level of like wealth and power and how we've decided to just let them accumulate that? I don't know.
Does anyone else think that a lift bridge that suddenly fails kind of reminds them of a guillotine? Just saying.
I mean, yes, you would not be the first person to make a guillotine riff off of that, but like, yes. But you know, I'd say, and not to be too totally flippant on this, but like, you know, this is why, you know, I've had the fortune to hang out with like Nick Hanauer, you know, who made, I think he's a billionaire and made that fortune selling a company years ago to Amazon. And Hanauer is the self-interested billionaire. Like, you know, he's totally in favor of wealth taxes because if not, there will eventually be pitchforks and torches. And, you know, billionaires should be offering to do that out of self-interest. So let's hope they listen to him. Let's see if they're as rational as they claim they are.
Well, let's take ourselves out of this winter of our discontent and onwards and upwards into February. It's the month of love.
Indeed, indeed it is. Well, I would say we've got some forthcoming guests. We'll get some more folks lined up in here so you don't just have to listen to us talk for the entire time. But I'm gonna go watch the opening ceremonies there and see who my kids cheer for there, which nation will choose to adopt. What was it? El Salvador had the amazing uniforms in the Summer Olympics, although based on their current president and his Bitcoin dreams, I don't think that'll be my nation state of choice. But obviously,
they're all gonna roll out in backwards ball caps.
I don't know. We'll see. Well, yeah, there is that. Well, yeah, McDonald's uniforms. That's what he was sporting most recently. Crypto riffs. But anyway, Dan, it's been a pleasure. We'll leave it there and return with more bad riffs very soon. Take away.